I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
So, good evening, everyone. I'm Nicola, just in case anyone gets confused, and this is Claudia Rankin. Let me start with the cheekiness out of the way. So, Claudia, it's an honour to sit with you again. I think last time we were together, it was warm. Much warmer. And it was for your play, your debut play, The White Card. But I'm sure we'll come on to that later. This evening, we're talking about your book, Plot. For those in the audience and at home who may not have yet read it, and note that I said yet, could you just summarise what it's about for us?
Plot. Thank you. Thank you for coming. I'm always like, you left your house. Major, major, major achievement. Plot is a book that I wrote, over 20 years ago, before I had a child, as a thought experiment around what it means to decide to be an artist and decide to be a parent. And what are the difficulties? And it was sort of a deep dive into all the fears, all the apprehensions, everything. And in conversation with Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse and Ingmar Bergman's Scene from the Marriage.
Okay. And so I didn't know what to expect when it arrived through my letterbox. So I've obviously read some of your other work. Most recently, Just Us. And so I opened it up expecting something very similar. And can I just do a show of hands? Who has read Plot? It's not out yet, is it? Is it out? Here. Okay. In the US. Thank you. And I actually had to pause because it's quite experimental in its form. And I had to let go of any preconceptions in terms of grammar and form and space and punctuation. And I had to take myself back to my English literature classes, which are very much predicated on also looking at form, yes, but also paying attention to feeling. And when I did that, it was a much smoother ride. Mm-hmm. And so could you just talk us through the style of how you wrote it and also how you arrived at the mindset or the energy in terms of the writing process?
First of all, let me say, not a poet. Or else there would be no hesitation.
Okay, interesting.
But reading, if you read Woolf, who I think is a closet poet, there's a lot of overlap. But the book has a lot of fragmentation. It has little conversations. It has, it's almost a internal ride in the way thoughts complete themselves or don't complete themselves, look and then turn and look again. And re-enter to see where else they can go. And so that's asking a lot of a reader.
Yeah.
But I think all poetry asks a lot of a reader because it's not dependent on narrative. It's not dependent on the sentence per se. It's not dependent on a linear life. You know, you're being asked to live in the place where you actually already live, which is inside you, in your thoughts, in the way you scan and consider and reject and embrace and reject and are fearful and reject, you know?
And that comes across really powerfully. Can you take us back to the moment of craft in this and how you arrived or put yourself into the mindset and the energy of the main protagonist, Liv?
I watched a lot of movies. I did. I was really interested in capturing the little moments in marriage. Those moments when, and we, in, you know, with all your partners, I think we have that moment where you have lived with this person and they're talking to you and you're watching them. And they're doing that thing, whatever that thing is. They're twirling their hair. You know they're about to not answer your question. You know that if they pick up that coffee cup, it's over, you know? And so I wanted to chart that. So I watched it happen. And I watched it in real life in cafes. And I mean, there are things in plot, there are conversations that actually I overheard. I was sitting in a cafe, and I remember this even though it's over 20 plus years. I was sitting in a cafe and there were two women, and one of them was pregnant. And she said to the other woman, "I love being pregnant because people pay attention to me." You know, suddenly I'm the person that's valued. And so that conversation was taken immediately and put in the We need that, you know. So it was a lot of gathering. And then craft-wise, this kind of writing is, you have to be incredibly meticulous because you could lose the reader if they don't feel, if they feel that intention is not intention. So they have to understand the repetitions as intentional. They have to understand the rhymes as intentional. They have to see that this is not just language cycling. It's language that was done to create a sensation within you. And it becomes a kind of poetics of accumulation in the body. You know, so it takes a while, but after a while you're in. Hopefully.
And did you worry about that balance between being in and holding on to the reader? Because there are moments when certainly I found I stepped away and then revisited and it's like, oh, okay, I can feel it again. Mm-hmm. But I had to pause. I had to really let go and kind of almost submit to you, submit to your words, submit to the text.
Well, I think people who are not practiced in reading poetry, and I know you're a brilliant person. But I think as a poet, you have a practice of being inside language in a certain way. And that means you're comfortable with fragmentation. You're comfortable moving in terms of the line, not the sentence. Mm-hmm. You trust the metaphors. But if you're a real writer like you, writing, you know, real books that address real issues, which, and I mean this seriously, these are issues I'm very concerned with, the ones you write about. Your job is to communicate the information. My job is to create a feeling about that information.
And they're different jobs.
They're different, but they overlap, because I don't think you're saying that plot is just for poets.
No, I'm saying plot is for feeling.
Okay.
You know, that it's I don't need you to apprehend every line.
Mm-hmm.
I need you to end in the fall. You know?
And we may come on to that, because I was really taken by how I felt when I got to the end, and like it wasn't what I expected at all. I was actually incredibly emotional. I was quite struck. I remember exactly where I was when I finished it. But we'll pause that and just come back.
Mm-hmm.
So Plot was originally published 2001 in the US. We're now 2023.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How do you think the 2023 reader will experience the book differently from the reader of 2001?
I think women and men and couples, everybody's still having kids. Everybody's still negotiating the cost of that. Everybody's still navigating what it means to be a working person, an artist, whatever, and have a family. And so in that sense, I think these questions remain. In the United States right now, with the repeal of Roe versus Wade, I think the question of women's bodies and choice and patriarchy, should I say that? are at top of mind. So suddenly, the question around choosing not to have a child, when I wrote Plot, that was owned by the woman and her partner in relation to her body. Now, depending on where you are in the United States, it's a different situation. And I think, given how close you all are to the United States, I would be a little nervous, too.
Yeah.
You know? So I think the world comes in, the politics of our freedoms and unfreedoms will push against the text in whatever way we feel relative to those politics.
You spoke earlier about real issues and feelings, and the book, in essence, is about Liv and her journey, her reflections, her anxieties as she goes through her pregnancy. And it's really quite profound, quite philosophical, sometimes dark in places. And I wondered if you could share with us a few words from Plot so that people in the audience and at home can get a flavour of the kind of energy and the feel and the cadence.
She says, I wonder, but she told me to read this.
No! You didn't want me. This is so elegant.
A short narrative of breasts and wombs entitled Liv Lying on the Floor, Looking at the Dirty Thought. The womb, similar to fruit that goes uneaten, will grow gray fur. The breast, a dying rose, darkening nipples, prickling sickness as it moves towards mold, a spongy moss. Liv, answer me this. Is the female anatomically in need of a child? As a life preserver, a hand up? And now, pap smeared, do you want harder the family you fear in fear of all those answers?
Thank you. There is a sense of foreboding around what happens to the female body, and certainly in terms of Liv and her reflections. And I wondered if you could unpack that, making reference back to the section that you've just shared with us.
Well, I think it's, for me, writing it, I was always layering the text onto Virginia Woolf's life. And so, like, the reference to Moss and getting there, I had this image of, I had read Woolf's diaries and Hermione Lee's biography, which I adore. It's like the best, read that. It's the best biography. And I was really interested in Woolf's thoughts about not having children, which, and that had to do with her own mental state. And I had this image of Woolf walking to the River Ouse and ending it all there. And so each of these, many of the moments in plot end with a kind of drowning. Mm. Because when the apprehension, the fears, the anxieties take over, it does feel like a kind of drowning. And it's a drowning you come up from, but it's a drowning. I think that's one definition of feeling overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And I once was listening to the theorist Lauren Bellant talk about the fact that sometimes she's crossing a street and she wants to throw herself in front of the car. She said, I just want to throw myself in front of the moving cars. And then I know I'm overwhelmed. I need to take a little time out. So nobody's throwing themselves in front of the cars, but the feeling of it is a kind of drowning, a kind of desire to end. And so often the language in the book ends up at the river, ends up in the drowning.
Yeah. And thank you. And I wondered also if you could say something about the relationship between Liv and Erland, her partner. So they're a straight couple, cis man and woman. Mm-hmm. And there's tiny, tiny moments or glimpses of interaction between them. And sometimes that interaction suggests playfulness. And there was a bit that made me smile, which didn't happen very much when I read the but where Erland asked Liv quite teasingly, he says, you know, will the baby be the only customer to her breasts? And I thought that was such a beautiful turn of phrase, the way that you articulated that. But actually, even though you did share these glimpses into their relationship, one is still left with a sense of solitude, of Liv's solitude. And I wondered if you could say a bit more about the relationship between the two and as she's contemplating this pregnancy.
Well, we all have that thing where, you know, it's a couple, whether it's a cis couple or a queer couple, when it's like, we're pregnant. I'm like, are we pregnant? Truly, we are trying to have a family, but are we pregnant? And so the book is inside the body of Liv. You know, it's about her journey, negotiating her anxieties around this possible birth. But the name Liv is taken from Liv Ullmann, and Erland is taken from Erland Jacobson, both from seeing the actors in Scene from a Marriage, not the characters, the actual actors. And I wanted the names because Liv, obviously, life, Liv. But Erland phonetically becomes her land. So even if he's not... if we're not hearing from him as much, the relationship is that he is her land. He is as much a part of the world that she's in as she is. So that's why I chose to use those names.
Okay. And could you say something a bit more? I wondered why we didn't see him as much, or she doesn't turn to him as much for consolation, to explore those feelings of anxieties, those moments of drowning. She seems to hold them in her head and in her mind.
Why don't they have a therapist?
But actually, this does connect to the next question for you, which is, because you talk about this, and invite you to hold on to that, but you talk about that sense of drowning. And I did wonder, where do women go to explore these thoughts? Do we hold them in our heads, those who have children or are thinking of having children? What spaces are available to them to set out these kinds of reflections?
Well, I've had people in the first go-round for Plot say it was lovely to read the book because it was a place for them to hear the things that they had thought but didn't feel like they could say.
Yes.
And because I wrote this book, you know, separate from the time that I got pregnant, I don't think I could have written it if I was pregnant, because I allowed myself to go any which way. If I had been pregnant, or even a moment adjacent to wanting to be pregnant, I would have thought, that's bad karma. I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. I just want to have a healthy child, and we are going to move forward to some positive thoughts here. But because I was imaginatively writing this, it allowed me to go to some of the worst places. But they're not unknown places for former readers of this book. And I think the mythology of motherhood has shut down that conversation. It's kind of, this is a hard segue, but it's kind of like talking about race, you know?
No, because that's not really a question. Go ahead.
Or whiteness. You know, we've been brought up to believe that to have those conversations are not polite, they're not, it might make somebody uncomfortable. And this is another form of those kinds of conversations, that you're not allowed to say, I am scared to death.
Yeah.
That I will be a bad mother, that the sins of my childhood would present themselves in the next iteration. And so I just wanted to be able to say it all.
Right. And actually, it does fit really beautifully with my next question, because, you know, as I said earlier, Claudia and I met on the set of her debut play, which showed at Soho Theatre last summer, The White Card, which is about race and whiteness and power and privilege, and which also speaks to your trilogy of books, one of which I have here, Citizen. And it strikes me that what sits across those works, the play and Plot, is this really astute observation of humankind, of human behaviour, and the body. And in Citizen, there's a really compelling and actually quite worrying in terms of the state of racism within society, but a case study of the racism experienced by the tennis player Serena Williams. And I wanted, if I may be so bold, to read just a little bit that's really struck me quite powerfully, because I'd be interested in your thoughts around this. So again, it's about the body. And you talk about the body having memory, which again seems to connect quite profoundly with Plot. This is on page 28 of Citizen, where you say, the physical carriage hauls more than its weight. The body is the threshold across which each objectionable call passes into consciousness. All the unintimidated, unblinking and unflappable resilience does not erase the moments lived through, even as we are eternally stupid or everlastingly optimistic, so ready to be inside, among, a part of the games. It's really powerful. I mean, it's a paragraph of maybe 8 lines. I wonder if you could speak to that for us, if you could unpack that for us.
Well, both in Plot and in Citizen, there is a sense that the thing convention has made us smaller. Mm. We are told it's not polite, it's not civil to speak out against, even against encroachment on our own freedoms. And certainly as women, we know this. You know, when you think about the fact that it has taken this long for Me Too to become a thing, mm-hmm. you're like, how did that happen? That is astounding. Sometimes when white women say to me, it's hard for me to talk about racism, I think, I get it, because you allowed yourself to be treated badly all this long in terms of sexism, in terms of feeling like you can step out and say no to this. And one of the things that Serena Williams showed us is that you can still be excellent at what you are doing and say no to the things that deserve a no.
Yeah.
And so she was working on all fronts. You know, she's playing tennis better than anyone ever. And she was yelling, no, 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 no. And people are like, she's crazy. She's rude. She doesn't know how to play the game. She doesn't know how to dress properly. She doesn't know how to walk properly. She can't dance properly. She can't do this. She can't do that. She's too black. She's too fat. She's too this. She's too that. And so she was having to navigate all of that to try and push the playing field towards something that was closer to fair. And she still won. You know, so she is an amazing example to all of us that we can still move forward in one way or another if we say no to the things that we should be saying no to.
And I wanted to explore that a little bit, because what I was really struck by in terms of what you've just said, but also that paragraph, is that sense of no matter how much you try and deny, no matter how resilient you are, no matter how it's still there. And importantly, and I don't think we're very good at discussing this, certainly because we're British and everything's very mm-hmm. civilized mm-hmm. and it's really about social class over here. Mm-hmm. So what you really pull out, both in terms of what you said just now, but also in the book, is the way that this still leaves a footprint. It stays with you. It affects the body, the mental health.
Yeah.
Could you explore that for us Brits? Because as I say, it's just about social class over here.
Well, no, I think it does take a toll on everyone. Saying no, if it were easy to say no, we would all say no. There's a cost to it. There's a cost to having to put yourself out there. There's a cost to interrupting the games, putting a snag in the moment. Mm-hmm. There is always a cost. And that's why it really matters who your people are and who's surrounding you and who you go home to at night. I mean, because it's like when it comes to racism and sexism and homophobia and anti-Semitism, all the isms, the days are a kind of maze of management.
Yes.
So you're always having to, is the no just going to be silence, or is the no no, or how active, how much mm-hmm. can this moment take? How much can I give? Can I give anything? Because I gave it last hour.
Do I want to?
Do yeah. I want to? Yeah. Do I want to? So it's a constant kind of settling of score, you know, in the body.
Yeah.
And it's happening inside before it reaches the other person.
Yes.
Lauren Ballant just wrote a book called The Inconvenience of Other People. And it is that. I mean, even when you want them there, even when you love them dearly, you're constantly having to negotiate their wants and their needs and their mistakes and your sudden strange reaction to X or Y thing. And, you know, one of the things I try to do with myself is to be brave enough to back up and say, oh, wait, what do I mean by that? You know, or why did I just say that? And so it's, you know, if you live like that 24/7, you'd probably go crazy.
Yes, but, yes.
But I do think that there are moments when it's important to do it because it says you value you and I value you.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And you're right, there are constant kind of micro calculations to mm-hmm. be made in terms of navigating society, whether you're going to, and I always use the example of whether I'm going to stay for the work Christmas dinner. Like, do I want to do that? It's risky. How long am I going to stay? Who should I sit next to?
Right.
Am I going to pre-plan the conversation so I can steer it to protect myself from these isms,
right.
from the likelihood of some of these isms?
Well, the slippage that happens
right.
when...
Right.
When you get a little inebriated there.
Yeah, exactly. That bit. And if I might just add, we've got a few more questions before we open up to the audience. I'm sometimes told that I am without hope when it comes to racial equity, which is not true. It's just I believe that the lens or the framework that we're using to understand race must be deconstructed and looked at more critically. So I'm going to perhaps take a little mean revenge on all those people who say to me, but do you have hope for change? Which I think is a really problematic question, actually, mm-hmm. but I would invite you to perhaps explore it with us this evening.
I just finished working with a conversation that's unpublished. A section of it is published in Athens magazines, but it was the last conversation, the only conversation between James Baldwin and Audre Lorde. And it's an important one because Audre Lorde's a grown-up and James Baldwin's a grown-up. And, you know, she says to him, we need to have hard conversations about things that are happening in the black community. And he says to her, you shouldn't blame black people for what white people are doing. And she says to him, but we all know what the white people are doing, but when you get home, you're now accountable to the people in your home. And you can't be doing these kinds of things. But so they're back and forth, and then somebody in the audience says, you sound so hopeless, because now everybody is failing everybody. And Baldwin says, because we're having this conversation, we can't be hopeless. Or else we wouldn't be having it.
At all, in the first
place. At all.
Right.
At all. We wouldn't be here. So I think when people say, "Are you?" I that question comes all the time.
Yeah.
And I just am like, why don't you just go live at Disney? and let us be done with it. Because life is not Disney. Life is a complicated, fucked up mess. And we are constantly in negotiation. And it's because people are constantly in negotiation that we're still here.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that the problems shouldn't be discussed.
Mm-hmm.
The only way to shift and move is to shift and move. And to name and to try and do better. And when you're doing better over here, something else is failing over there. I just want people, I'm not going to do it. I was going to make a joke and say, I just want people to get along. But
To hold hands.
To hold hands. No, but I really think that we have to understand that there's no pause in difficulty.
Yeah.
But there is the possibility of shifting, of openness, of discussion, of, and I think we're in one of those moments now, actually. People say to me, people my age say to me, I want to stop teaching. It's too difficult. The kids nowadays, they're so sensitive. And I say, you mean they're accountable? They're accountable to language. And they're asking us to be accountable too. And that's not something to step away from. But does it make life more difficult? Yes. You just want to go and go automatic. But no. And that actually is a good thing. That's how shifts happen. It doesn't feel good.
The discomfort is necessary.
It's necessary.
Thank you. And my final question before we move to the audience. Plots was written, published in 2001, and a lot has happened, not to put too fine a point on it, since mm-hmm. that time. And certainly in the UK context, we have become much more aware of some of racial disparities. And I'm thinking in particular the data around Black women being more likely to die in childbirth. How would Plot be different, do you think, if you were to write it today?
I think it would be hard not to include that kind of information. Much of what's in Plot is about Liv's own feelings of inadequacy, as I've said. But there's not a lot in there about her chances given the world, given systemic racism, given the fact that Black women and their children, despite their class status, are more likely to die in childbirth than white women. I think there was an article in Times recently that said the richest Black women have a higher immortality rate than the poorest white women. And that is just racism. That is just doctors telling you, you don't know what, it's like these people, they think they have good intentions, but unless they begin to unpack their own racism, they won't see it. But it shows up in not listening. I mean, and everybody's talked about this. Michelle Obama, Serena Williams, everyone. I told the doctor, I think this is happening. He says, you don't know what you're talking about. I remember when I was in hospital, there was a woman in the room with me, and she was moaning, and I'll just be 100% honest. I was irritated by her moaning, too. It was, keeping me up at night. And because I was up, I saw the nurses come in and out, and they kept saying to her, there's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you. She was a Black woman. And then in the morning, it turns out she had some huge infection. And this is how it starts. Mm-hmm. A kind of dismissing of, and that speaks to how a person is valued.
Thank you. That feels like a slightly unhappy note to end up. But I wondered, just before we move to questions, if you could just say something about, I know there's an exhibition that relates to the book, just so that people are aware of it and can catch it.
Well, when the book was first published, because Liv was sort of modeled on Lily Briscoe in To the Lighthouse, there were pages that had these little canvas word paintings. And so in New York at the Kitchen, we invited artists to make Liv art. And And people did. And we had a show at the Kitchen. And so this time around, in this iteration, I said to Donald, my editor at Penguin, perhaps we could do it again at Chelsea. So Chelsea Art Space has put, the gallery at Chelsea, has put together a show. And the work was created by, again, artists in New York and Singapore and all over the United States, which I brought over in my suitcase. And their own students. And it's really quite incredible. It'll be up only this week. So if you're over there by the British Museum, the Tate Britain, it's next door. You should pop in and you'll see Art for Plot.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Thank you. So, we have some time for questions. We have questions, obviously, from here from the bookshop, but also potentially online. Are there any questions from the audience, please? It can be about any of Cordia's work, I think. Yes?
Yes, good. Or your work.
Thank you.
Yeah, hi. Great to see you in the flesh. I've been watching you on YouTube for a long time.
Oh.
But
it
actually feels like I'm in the room, in your front room.
Go because home, you so. Are.
Oh, yeah.
This is my new home.
I wanted to ask you about Just Us. It's a process I'm really enjoying reading, and because I make art as well, and I'm a writer and a poet, so all of that is working really well for me. Do you think there'll be any more books like that in the future?
Right now, I'm failing badly at trying to work on a new book that I've been looking at all of these people like Navalny, and I know he's a nationalist, whatever, but Masha Amini, you know, people who do things that. It's the Antigone moment that in grasping life, they also have to grasp death at the same time. That you can't separate the two things. And in Masha Amini's case, she, as we know, she loosened her headscarf. She was killed in Iran. But then people came out in objection to her killing, but they too, in coming out, had to, in order to value her life, they had to grasp their own death and know that. And Hegel writes that the moment that you're able to do that is the moment that the state no longer has control over you. And the same thing with Navalny. Navalny, normally, are we interested in him? Not so much. But the fact that he has decided or decided after Putin tried to kill him to return to Russia, knowing he was walking into his own death a second time. So I'm sort of trying to struggle to get to the language of that, because I'm convinced that it has something to do with a kind of revolutionary hope, which is what that conversation between Baldwin and Lord is called. And that in order to achieve freedom as you know it should be, like you intuitively know it should be, you're going to have to give up the comfort of the illusion of a long life. You know, it sounds bad. but we're seeing these people doing it. And then we're seeing movements of people coming out in support of them, and so consequently doing it again. And we're also seeing the state coming down on these people and killing some of them. So it's like, how do you take that and bring it to the page in a way that doesn't need that explanation? That's what I'm working on.
Thank you. Any more questions? We have, yes, one and then two, please. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hello. Hi.
Good evening. I haven't read Plot. I'm really excited to, but I have read.
Give me that.
Oh, no, sorry, I'm getting kicked out. But I have read Just Us and I have read Citizen, and I'm really intrigued by the early comments about the experimental nature of the work.
That's because I'm not a poet.
So yeah, with all that in mind, I'm if you're, you know, you wrote the book in 2001 or maybe before 2001, do you think that the experimental nature of the work was a reflection of the time, or was it more about a reflection of just what you wanted to write at the time? And do you think in general that time, the nature, the state of the world that we're in reflects the experimental nature of work, particularly poetry, or not? And if so, why?
That's a good question. You know, I will tell you that it was easier to publish Plot than it was Don't Let Me Be Lonely. You know, Plot was published by Grove Press. And they were like, oh, this is poetry. When I wrote Don't Let Me Be Lonely, they said, we can't publish this. It's God sent it. What is this? This is not the, you know, poetry. And so in some circles, the later work is actually more experimental than this.
Interesting.
Depending on who the audience is, yeah. You know? And so they kicked me out of Grove, and I was a little upset because they published Beckett, and I love Beckett, and I was like, I have the same publisher as Beckett. But then I got Grey Wolf, and they were great in the States, and then Penguin here. So it all worked out. But so when I was writing Plot, it's experimental, but, you know, Lewis Hyde says about poetry, it's outside of the market economy. And it allows then the writer to do whatever they want. So I've always felt that in the realm of poetry, you can, it's the one genre that is not meeting market. You know, I have friends who write children's books, and that world is so controlled. It's like, you can't use that word, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do that. Whereas the world of poetry is probably the most open place, except when you write Don't Let Me Be Lonely, apparently. But now, you know, now people have there's a tradition of working in image and text, and so now the work is just part of what is understood to be under that umbrella.
Thank you. And there's another question. Thank you.
Sorry. Hi, Claudia.
Hi.
So my mom is watching on Zoom in the U.S. and she has a question. Could you talk about the many meanings of the word plot as important to narrative, but also as a plot of earth, a grave plot, a secret plan, etc.?
Exactly. The title plot was the reason the word is the title is because of the multiple meanings. And it contained both the idea of a storyline, a plot, and a plan, obviously, and also a grave. And these were all thematically relevant to the possibilities of where we were going, whether we were following Wolf to the River Ouse or fighting in scenes of a marriage or using language to describe my own husband. I'm like, what the f-? You know, whatever is going on. The word became a kind of umbrella word. And then throughout the book, there are moments when the titles are words that are contained in other words. I love this, when you start looking, you can't find what you want. But but there are many words within the book that are pulled out of their adjacency to another word. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to show how the word lives independently and also in relation to, which is true for all of us here. We are independent people, but we are in adjacent to those of us who are around us and having to make adjustments to that all the time. Thank you. Say hi to your mom.
Are there any more questions? Make sure I'm not missing anyone at the back. Hi. Hello. Hi. Question right here.
Thank you for your wonderful discussion. Oh, sorry. Thank you for your wonderful discussions. I thought I had a citizen book, but I think I borrowed it from the library and I couldn't find it myself. So I bought all your books. But I wonder, you know, you as a well-known author and writer, and you probably get introduced quite a lot. I just wonder, maybe it's a bit off the plot, that how would you like to be known yourself? Like, how do you see yourself as Claudia Rankin? How?
Thank you.
Oh, that's such a...
Could everyone hear at the back? Wait, super.
That, I have never been asked that question in my life, in my long life. How do I see myself? I'm going to be honest. I'm talking to myself. you know, I think my husband and I have this joke that on my tombstone, it should say, I didn't sign up for this. But I think I would love to see myself as someone who listens. You know, and I do try to listen. And if I think I'm not going to listen, I will write down on a piece of paper, that's a secret, but I will write down on a piece of paper, listen. Because I think it's so easy to lose the person in front of you, so easy to project onto them what you want to say. It's like my job. That's my job, to listen. Beyond the writing, I don't think the writing could happen if I wasn't listening to myself, to you, to George Bush, to, you know, really, to the world, actually. I'm really interested in how a thing gets said. And what's the tail end of it? What's the wake of it? How
how should I be feeling about this? You know, long before Trump was president, I was saying to people, he's going to be president. We are in a state of emergency. And people are like, I'm like, aren't you listening to him? Aren't you listening to the people who are talking to him? So I think I'd like to be known as somebody who listens.
Thank you.
I do have a question. There's several, actually, and I don't know if we'll be able to go. But this is from Malika Booker.
Oh, Malika. Hi, Malika. Where are you?
I hope she heard that.
She's
Claudia,
lovely.
Do you want me to go in? Claudia, as a poet, I would like to ask about your writing process. How much time is spent in conceptual reflection before the writing begins? Or is the writing process part of your conceptualization? And when does form present itself? To clarify, when do you know what form the writing will take?
Hi, Malika, wherever you are. I spend a lot of time thinking. When I'm not listening, I'm thinking. And I'm not a poet who writes poems. I write books. So I will think about a thing for a long time, and I'm reading, and I'm thinking, and I'm talking. And, you know, I have the honor of having an assistant who's also a poet who's here tonight, Emily Skillings. And Emily said to me recently, why don't you start taking the things you're thinking about and write them down? And so that's the only reason I even attempted to start working on the new book, because I spend a lot of time kind of circling, when you know, it's an amazing moment. It happens. It doesn't happen here. It could, but it doesn't. At a desk, it happens. Maybe you see a billboard, or a taxi driver says something to you, or you say something and it clicks. Something, you know, it's like I have all these pieces and they click.
Yeah.
And then I can go. And then you start working and it's frustrating. And then you know you've got it when it gets boring. And then you just want to finish it. You're like, oh, I know what I'm doing. And now I just want to finish it. But for a while, it's just frustrating. And then it's boring. And that's when it turns into work. And, you know, you're like, this is like my job.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
We have one more online.
Sure.
This is from Anthony. This is from Tricia.
Tricia.
My colleague is Anthony. Tricia asks, my question is, which young writers do you admire and would recommend that we read?
I feel like I'm being set up. But tomorrow, actually, I'm having a conversation with the author of Poor. How many people have read that book?
Yeah.
It is stunning. Stunning, Femi Kalib. And you read a book and the person is out there in the world, in this case, across the waters, but you know that they're your friend. And so I feel very, very lucky that I will be in conversation with him tomorrow somewhere.
please.
At Foyles, at Foyles Book. I wasn't going to say it because we are here. That was intentional.
Publicist.
But yes, tomorrow I'll be in conversation with him at Foyles. And I'm not saying it because I'm in conversation with him at Foyles. I'm saying it because I really think you should all read Poor. And he is incredible. And he also works, unlike me, he doesn't have to buy the rights to images. He actually takes photographs himself, and they're in the book. It's really phenomenal.
Thank you. How are we for time?
It is 8:05.
Okay. So we're supposed to wrap up and be good. Should we squeeze one more in? Are people okay for time? And we've got one here. Who you can decide who takes precedence. We've got one. And pressure for a chair. We'll do it's a gentleman.
Well, we can do two. Yeah.
Thank you.
Is that all right? Can you hear?
Yes, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So I'm a teacher and I teach a lot of poetry and I love it. But one of the challenges I sometimes find is it can be really hard to get pupils to engage with poetry in any meaningful way. And especially also modern poetry, they might think it's too hard or like confusing, whatever. Do you have any advice for how to broaden the readership of poetry and make people like it who haven't liked it before? Because we all love it.
Thank you. Drink that milk. Yes. Well, you know, I do have some ideas actually, and it's old ideas. You know that poets like T.S. Eliot used to be able to fill stadiums. And I think poetry should be heard on the radio. I mean, it's really an oral activity, and there's so much work that goes into the cadence, the all of it. And you know, we're all listening to the BBC, we're listening to PBS, we're listening. They should have little 5-minute sections where right before the 12 o'clock news, you listen to a poem. You know, because I think when people begin to hear it, they'll get less afraid. Because it's not, poetry is just language. But because it defies the rules of grammar at times, or it defies the rules of expectation, there's that kind of, I won't get it. I don't, but you do know. You do know. You will get it if you open to it. You know, I recently got a trainer, and I learned, I had this hip thing. We were just talking about this. And so my trainer would say to me, bend down and do this. And I would have to think, like, it's not going to hurt. But I think it's going to hurt. So I don't want to do it. And so I had to pause before the action to think, it's not going to hurt. So it's like that with poetry. You have to let down the guard that says, because this is not functioning like a newspaper article, I will be able to understand this. It's just habits of reading. It really is just habits of reading.
Thank you. And our final question from online. Thanks, Natalia.
And listening.
Yep, you're listening.
Final question is from Kate. Claudia, can you tell us more about your work in relationship to your love of Samuel Beckett's work? Is Citizen the new Waiting for Godot, perhaps?
You know, I have this poem by Fred Moten on my phone. And it goes something like this. They want them to say, I see it, I see it. They want them to say, this is a, you know, not actually how it goes, but it says something like this. I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And then he says, I don't know if I can say this, but then he says, silly motherfuckers.
Just give it up and move on. And what was the question? I was trying hard. Beckett. Oh, Beckett. And so,
this isn't Beckett.
So this idea that citizen is something that is trying to show a thing, I want to let that go. And I want to just move into a space of not waiting for anything. You know, where somebody said to me recently that Beckett was all about waiting for. And I think we can't wait for white people to understand the situation that black people find themselves in.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
We're going to have to just go. We're going to have to just go. So so I don't think I love Beckett, but I don't think I am signing up for a poetics of waiting. Hence, my new revolutionary hope.
I think that's a perfect place to actually end. Claudia, it's a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.